The Meaning of Geranium from The Secret Language of Plants by Andrina, read by Sam Gabriel, based on the works of J.K. Rowling. Chapter 6. Learning to Fly. Draco dressed warmly and with tight clothes to avoid the sound of rustling fabric in the wind. He also put on Sirius's jacket rather than a cloak. He combed his hair back carefully. He tried on 7 pairs of gloves before settling for the ones that fit best. He spent the better part of an hour pondering whether he ought to take the fire poker or the old Quidditch bat he had found with the brooms. The poker was too long, but the bat was too old and the wood felt brittle. He had just decided on a switch that may or may not have been used to punish the house elves, too ornate to tell, when Harry finally came tiptoeing to the backyard. He had a bag slung across his chest and was so focused on zipping up his coat in silence that he did not notice that Draco was standing there. "Do you have your wand?" asked Draco. "Good. Let's go, then." Harry yelped, jumped, did a double take while he stepped back and somehow managed to fall down on his ass. Ah, the hero of the wizarding world. Of course Harry insisted adamantly that he should go alone, and that it was too risky, and Draco was underage and had no wand, and what would happen to him if the Death Eaters found him, he, the blood traitor child. Draco took a deep breath, straightening to his full height. He was sure he was at least a finger taller than Harry. "How come Weasley hasn't attempted to strangle you at any point during these past years?" Draco said. "The hypocrisy of this boy, really." "You don't have to do everything alone. I'm sure that one of your friends might have mentioned something in that respect." "But I'm head of the Interhouse Solidarity Party, Potter. Don't make me give you a speech on union strength." Harry smiled at that. They used their surnames like other people use full names. It was all Harry and Draco when they were cooking and reading and taking naps, but then it became Potter and Malfoy when they had to say things like, "Malfoy, do you have a death wish? Why would you poke that?" And, "Under what light could you possibly think that combination of garments was remotely acceptable, Potter?" And on one memorable incident with a hat, "I can't believe we are god siblings, Potter," which sent Harry to the floor laughing from the ridiculousness of it. At least Harry accepted defeat easily. He nodded his head and took the broom Draco offered him without arguing. The brooms were, well, they were old and different. They had nothing of the sleek and elegant design of the Nimbus and the Firebolt. Draco insisted on having them take a few loops to get used to them, and Harry agreed. They were big and tough, and they felt sturdier than anything he had ever used. Harder to steer, but with a lot of power in them. Hard to steer and hard to stop. Then Draco pointed them west to his family home. Harry did not ask if he was sure that Hermione would be there. He accepted it without question or comment. Harry was a disastrous, hapless wizard, and it was a veritable mystery that he had gotten to this age alive. He was also unfailingly kind at the right times. Kind in the small moments and with small actions, like now, that he didn't ask Draco if he was sure if his family involvement was a kindness, just as when he didn't question his presence in Leeds. It took them a little over 2 hours of uninterrupted flight to get there. They flew in a line at first, Draco taking point and Harry behind, but after a while they ended up flying side by side. Harry had a memory. Back in the village there had been a man, probably a young man, but to child Harry all adults were equally ageless in their adulthood state, and 20 was the same as 50. The man had a girlfriend who worked in a clinic 2 towns over, and she took the bus there. But sometimes, perhaps when the man got out of work early, or perhaps when it was sunny, Harry had no way to know, the man went to pick her up. He rode on his bike, a bit hunched and eyes straight ahead, and with his right hand he brought along his girlfriend's bike. Harry wouldn't have paid attention, but he had the memory of Remus stopping to see him go. Harry had been in his arms, he had probably tired himself out playing, and while Remus carried him, he stopped and watched the man with the 2 bikes, who on sunny days went to pick up his girlfriend just for the pleasure of seeing her earlier and riding back with her. Harry couldn't say who had moved first, him or Draco, just that they were flying side by side and that they had both extended an arm to grab the other's broom. He had had no idea. He wondered if people had seen it, if they had realized how similar they both were. The closest he had seen was Fred and George when they played beater on the Gryffindor team and moved like one single entity. Draco and he had practically the same height and the same frame, and they were both seekers. Draco and he shared an understanding, a common grace when flying. They should have fallen from the brooms so big and heavy at the first gust of wind. But instead they were steering each other and moving with easy synchronicity like partners in a dance. They would have never seen it, playing on rival teams. And there was no need for that kind of flying in Quidditch. But it was sort of easy and sort of nice to fly intertwined in this manner as they approached Malfoy Manor and the dangers it housed. They flew like one and moved like one. Like one, they saw the dark figures circling in the sky and descending toward the tree line, like ravens falling over a corpse. They shared a look and they didn't have to speak to know what they would do. Perhaps this was magic too, a magic so old and subtle no one had thought of teaching them about it. They lifted their hands from each other's brooms, brooms so big and heavy. Tomorrow Draco would have purple bruises on his thighs, he could tell. Tonight, though, he descended like a medieval knight on a big war horse, bringing with him a rain of pine leaves. He used his momentum to turn around with such force that Uncle Rabastin was thrown off of his broom and to the ground. And Granger fell right into his arms. Neat.
I got her!
He called to Harry as he kicked the ground to take off. Handless, he would like to note. It is one thing to go handless when you are hovering in the air, but if you take off with no hands, chances are you will find yourself with a face full of broom handle and a bloody nose. But Draco took off perfectly and even compensated for the added weight, gathering Granger towards him with his left arm. The right was holding the switch tightly, and Draco hit an approaching wizard on the face with it, perhaps one of the Averys, given how nasal his scream of pain was. Harry stayed behind. Harry had a wand and was currently free of passengers, so it made sense that he would stay and try to keep them at bay to give Draco a head start. He had survived the Dark Lord in the Triwizard Tournament. Draco didn't have a clear picture of what happened, but he knew Harry had survived something. And he survived the fall with the special operators. Plus, Draco had seen him perform some really weird and powerful magic. He said all this to himself in the few seconds that it took to fly to the treetops. It didn't help with the lump of tension in his throat.
Wingardium Leviosa!
He heard Harry exclaim, because yes, why not? Five Death Eaters, five adult wizards trained in the Dark Arts. Of course you should confront them with a first-year basic spell. He should have just given his wand to Draco. It wouldn't be as good as his own, but at least Draco had enough sense to cast Stupefy. Rabastin was coming after him. Draco turned and hit him with the switch. He could hear Aunt Bella below screaming madly. Draco lashed again with the switch, drawing blood. Rabastin was flailing, but Draco could see, and he was a seeker. He was experienced in flying. He saw the movement before Rabastin himself, how he grabbed the handle of his broom intent on pushing back and away from Draco's range. Once he did that, he could cast a spell, any spell, and Draco would have no way to stop it and no cover. The switch was hazel, which made for temperamental and emotional wands, and through the years it had soaked up the blood and sweat and tears of dozens of magical creatures. A pain that now surged from the point of the rod in the form of a scream and a purple stream of tenuous light. It hit Rabastin right in the chest. He barely got to keep his balance on the broom and he dropped his own wand. Draco did a weird sound of triumph, too surprised and scared to get anything better than a goat's bleat. He seems to have accidentally swallowed the lump of tension that he had been carrying in his throat, which now took residence above his heart together with the timidly raising hope. To be honest, he had accompanied Harry fully expecting his fall and death. If anything, he could offer to trade himself for Granger, and he knew his father wouldn't pass up the opportunity to punish him. While his family was occupied doing so, maybe Harry could take her and run away. Of course, he had hoped that that wouldn't be the case, but what a Slytherin hopes and what he plans for are often very different things. It was important that Draco had made peace with his decision before time, so it would be easier when the time came. Now, however, it seemed like they might get away after all. And it better be the three of them, because if Draco escaped with Granger, she would insist on coming back to rescue Harry, and then they would be in the same situation all over again, and Draco would rather not. Although at least that rescue would involve a decent witch to even the odds. Someone who couldn't cast Wingardium Leviosa for all the hairs in Merlin's beard. He dared to look down. Harry was flying up, followed closely by three wizards. Not Bella, though. Bella was still on the ground. Bella was fighting her own robes. The hem. Harry must have been aiming at the hem when he cast Wingardium Leviosa. His aunt was exposed from the waist down, the robes having folded up in the abdomen, constricting her arms and covering her head completely. One would think her screams would be muffled under so much fabric. Draco didn't think much of his next actions. It had worked with Rabastin, so he simply pointed the switch down to the three wizards chasing Harry and wished. It had worked well against Rabastan, yes. And the three of them might make it out of here alive. Draco could count on one hand how many times in his life he had felt this happy. One would have been saying no to his father because, as painful as it was, it had been so freeing and he had felt like he could fly. And then living with Sirius and Remus and Mad Harry, and somehow realizing he was not completely alone in the world. Those short summer months had been the best of his life, even if he also did a lot of crying during them. Gosh, his birthday! What a wonderful day, and how hard he had cried. He didn't say the words. He could swear he didn't even think them. But a Patronus sprouted from the switch nevertheless. A big feline figure. A cat. It's a cat, everyone. No one dares say anything else. It's a cat. That jumped down and trashed the three men. Harry ascended to Draco's level and got a hold of his broom swiftly and naturally. And they started to move. Not the fastest, these brooms. But once they got them going, they wouldn't stop easily either. Draco's Patronus kept the wizards back for a little while. And wasn't that marvelous? Harry could only spare 3 seconds of thought, but the brain can think a lot of stuff in 3 seconds. He thought that they had Hermione, thank all the freaking gods, yes, and that they were going to be fine, and even though there was a war, they were going to win. And Harry would get rid of Voldemort and make sure everything was all right, and there was cake in the end. And afterwards he would go back to living with Remus, and possibly Severus, too, if he wanted to come. Surely he would want to be with Remus and him. Sirius could be there, too, and Draco, although they would need a bigger house. A big house with at least 4 bedrooms, and it would be really nice, and everybody would get along. And Harry had to make sure this was important. Please, brain, remember for the future. He had to make absolutely certain that he was there when Sirius discovered the shape of Draco's Patronus. Better yet, he would like to be the one to tell him. Because Harry had the impression that once Sirius learned that Draco Malfoy's Patronus was a freaking lion, or rather a lioness, he was going to have a laughing fit that would send him to the floor and forever wash the gloom of Azkaban away. He was going to do that. For now, he was steering them east and looking over his shoulder. The Patronus vanished soon after, but it would still take the Death Eaters a few seconds to gather themselves. Rabastan, however, came up in a blast of curses and jinxes. He had been down looking for his wand when the Patronus fell over the rest. He leaned over his broom and threw himself towards them at full speed.
"Draco, take your broom!" said Harry.
Draco threw him an indignant look because he was rather occupied, but he did it anyway. His left arm was still tight against Hermione's limp body, and he had to hold the switch with his mouth, which even now he could feel falling apart from the magic outburst, to hold the broom with his right hand. But now Harry also had a hand free, both hands actually, because he stopped his broom and let Draco gain some distance. There was no way they would chase them when Harry was standing right there. He saw Rabastan snarl as Harry turned around and rummaged in his bag. He'd read a fairy tale about this, and not 2 years ago there had been a fascinating article discussing that specific piece of folklore in Magical Review. Mostly it said that, while possible, it was a type of transformation that required an incredible amount of power. Harry was sure McGonagall would be able to pull it off. Maybe that's why she almost kept her hair in a tight bun. She would have access to bobby pins. In his hand, he was holding a comb. The good, trusty comb that had survived the fall with him and multiple offensives on Harry's hair. The very best, the ultimate comb. Harry brought it to his lips and kissed it before throwing it in Rabastan's direction. By the time it reached the wizard, the comb had already grown to 100 times its size, and the teeth were twisting and stretching. It hit Rabastan straight in the chest and he fell. His broom, a moon trimmer model, flew past Harry and was lost in the night. The fall didn't kill Rabastan, however, because he was cushioned by his brother Rodolphus under him. Rodolphus managed to hold on to his broom while the swiftly growing mass of thorns fell over both of them and pushed them down. It was not quite as spectacular as the forest of thorns and needles in Sleeping Beauty, but with the size of 3 houses and branches as thick as Harry, it was good enough to keep everyone pinned there for a while. Bella had returned to the house in such a state of fury that it took them a while to make out her words. They had to follow her back to the edge of the forest for anything to begin to make sense. Narcissa found with surprise that she was secretly pleased that the mudblood girl had escaped, and that it was easy to hide her pleasure in silence and the shadow of her husband.
"They came for her!" snarled Bella.
She had foam in her mouth and was gritting her teeth hard. Narcissa feared she would need a meta-wizard later to look at her jawbone.
"The abomination!"
"And who would that be?"
asked Lucius calmly as he poked at one of the hard black branches with his cane.
Harry Bulger!
Answered Bella, more animal than human. This got Lucius's attention, as well it should.
And you let him escape?
Lucius didn't like Bella, and Bella didn't like anyone other than the Dark Lord. Narcissa stood there quietly while they tore each other apart with words. The thorns, to give them a name, were kind of pretty to look at in a way, like gargantuan black lace. But then Bella thrashed and sent a low blow.
Yes, him! He came for her with the other one, the blood traitor!
For some reason, she turned to look at Narcissa directly.
Your son!
I have no son, Narcissa said quickly and quietly.
She had plenty of training to make it sound natural. If her voice wavered, no one would know why. They would all think it was shame. Her boy, her little boy.
He hit me in the face!
Called Rabastin from somewhere in the thick cage of thorns. They had been there for 20 minutes and they still couldn't get a glimpse of him. All they knew was that he was upside down. He had complained loudly about it, and that he was in the vicinity of someone's bottom. He had complained about that, too.
He hit me, too!
Came the nasal voice of the Junior Avery. Lucius cut the discussion short. It was shameful. 5 grown wizards defeated by 2 teenagers, one of them almost a squib, and the other wandless. Bella answered that Lucius should have been there, and Lucius said something vaguely offensive. Narcissa turned her attention back to the mini forest of thorns. It looked like a plant, but the material was hard and dead to the touch. Snape arrived soon after, with the first lights of the morning, called by Lucius, no doubt. Narcissa had never liked him. There was something disgustingly oily about him, but Lucius liked him, and he spoke with him and of him with an easy camaraderie, as if they had shared so many things. And Snape spoke. He spoke with such a beautiful voice that shouldn't belong to someone like him. He didn't deserve a voice so pleasant, like a musical instrument. He used words precisely and delicately, and Narcissa hated, that Lucius delighted in Snape's words while she had to be silent. She was not jealous of the women her husband visited. They were just bodies, after all. But she was jealous of that friendship. It was ridiculous, because Lucius was better friends with Theodore Knott Sr. Certainly he spent more time with him. But he did not speak with him as he did with Snape. Snape looked at the snarling mass of thorns.
When you called me, I did not expect that you needed my help with gardening, he said.
And his voice was like the velvet inside a rose's petal.
Can you remove it?
Lucius asked, easily ignoring what would have caused offense in anyone else's mouth. Snape extended a long, pale finger to touch one of the branches. He poked at it with his nail. Snape's hands were almost as meticulously manicured as Narcissa's.
A simple incendio should work.
There are people in here!
Cried Rabastin.
And do you particularly care about them?
In the end, they had to use 5 different cutting and slashing curses to hack at the thick branches, as Defindo did very little beyond peeling the hard black crust. Snape said something about business at Hogwarts and left immediately after wishing them good luck and bowing to Bella, who hissed at him. Perhaps this is why Lucius liked him so much. They didn't get to the core of the Thorn Forest until almost an hour before tea time. By then Rabastin, who had indeed been upside down, had passed out. Avery Jr. had been sick, and his vomit had somehow gotten all over everyone else, a fact of which they didn't fail to inform them. Hermione drifted in between vigil and sleep, before waking up completely. She was hurting terribly, and she was in bed, a big bed with fluffy pillows and at least 2 duvets. She was still naked, but someone had bandaged her left arm. Harry. That was Harry's head, and folded arms resting on the bed. Hermione didn't move. She didn't say anything. This could be an illusion, some new torture conjured up by Bellatrix. She looked at the scene in silence, unmoving. The room was full of Gryffindor decoration and paraphernalia, just like one would expect if this were a mirage. There was also a small divan, a few steps behind Harry's chair, currently occupied by Draco Malfoy, whose neck would later complain about the posture, no doubt. That was a bit more unexpected. Harry woke soon after. And at his joyful exclamation that Hermione was awake, so did Draco, who wished her well and immediately excused himself from the room. He had a hand already pressing on the back of his neck. Harry had quite a lot of experience with waking up confused and in pain in strange rooms, so he was very well prepared to give Hermione an abridged explanation of what had happened and where she was. Still, Hermione looked at him, blinking slowly and almost uncomprehending. She felt as if she were barely occupying her body, as if any second either the room or her would cease to exist. "Do you have any questions?" said Harry. His hair was as messy as always and maybe a bit longer. His eyes were the same green eyes. But she didn't know. She didn't... "Is this real?" she said at last. How could she know if this was real? If she were dying and this were a hallucination of her mind, she wouldn't mind. But if this was a trick, and she would later find herself back in that cell, and if this was a trick, and Harry's face turned into Bellatrix's, and the bedroom gave way to that dreaded ballroom, she couldn't take it. She couldn't... Harry was giving her a glass of water. He didn't seem surprised in the least by her question. "I was the first person to learn about your family trip," he said, raising his brows to indicate what he meant by that. "The day you taught me how to make a braid. You and Ron helped me escape Hogwarts. Nobody knows who managed to pull that prank on the twins this summer of the Quidditch Championship, but I've always thought it was you. Although everybody blamed Ginny and Bill. Oh no, in our first year at school we smuggled a baby dragon."
"You what?"
Draco said from the door. "No, actually, you know what? I don't want to know. Make room, Harry. Granger, I brought you soup." So he had. A big steamy bowl with a piece of bread next to it, all carefully arranged on a tray. "I was just telling her stuff so she knows this is real and not an illusion or something." "Oh, I see. In that case, I don't think anyone has ever mentioned this, but after 8 p.m, Potter asks the weirdest questions, and he's very insistent that an answer is provided. You must have endured this, I am certain."
"Well, no, I don't,"
argued Harry, who just 2 nights ago had poked Draco when he was falling asleep to ask if all planets rotated counterclockwise or if it was just Earth.
"That's not true,"
he added, honestly surprised and ignorant of this character trait.
"It kind of is, Harry," said Hermione, smiling despite how tired and in pain she was.
When they went to the Quidditch World Cup, Harry asked when was nail polish invented, how come they never saw baby penguins, whether wizards from other countries used the same words for spells, and who was more likely to get a tattoo, Bill or Charlie, all on the same night. She took the spoon and started to eat. It is one of the most unfair rules of life. You can create a lot of damage in just a second, but you can't take it back in the same short interval. Healing takes a long amount of time. Hermione went through the motions in a daze: eat, get dressed, go down to the kitchens, undress, bathe. It wasn't until she was clean and swaddled in thick, warm clothes that it all came to her, and she started to cry. Draco abandoned the room so quickly it could be said he had managed wandless apparition. Harry stayed, though. Harry took her in his arms and didn't shush her or make any of the noises you do to calm someone down. None of those, "it's all right." It was not. It was not all right at all. He let her cry and he hugged her close, which was exactly what Hermione needed. It was not all right, but she had survived, and one day she was going to be. Draco ventured back into the kitchen well over an hour later. As soon as he stepped in, he was hugged by Hermione, who, like everyone at Hogwarts, thought he might be dead or locked in a tower on a Greek island, and Draco was a complete idiot for thinking Hermione wouldn't be glad to see him no matter what had happened at the manor. "Shut up and hug me back." And Draco, who didn't have much experience, but who had gotten a crash course on hugging and physical affection this summer with Sirius, hugged Hermione tightly and tried to convey without words how glad he was that she too was alive. How glad that she could still look him in the eye. It was close to 5 in the afternoon. They had spent much of the day sleeping, all three of them. Nighttime rescues are tiring business. Now they found themselves with the usual discomfort after spending a whole night awake, when you were tired and half-hungry and unsure of what to eat and whether you should go back to sleep or try to stay awake until nighttime so you won't ruin your sleeping pattern. It never ends with the torture. The trauma, it never ends. Even when you escape and you are out, you made it, and your friends, your loyal mad friends, came to your aid. Even then, there are these things that remain, that remind you of what happened and bring you back to that moment when you lost ownership of yourself. The boys hadn't done much beyond bandaging her arm and putting her in a warm bed, while Draco had scoured the library for every text on metamagic, while Harry comforted her in the kitchen. But the thing is that Draco was wandless, and Harry had zero confidence in what he could do with his wand, so it would be up to her to heal herself with Harry's wand, which was extremely temperamental and, much like Harry, insisted on doing its own thing. It wasn't fair that Hermione would have to be the one checking her body, undoing Bellatrix's harm. It wasn't fair that she would have to take account of everything that had been done to her so soon after her escape. Hermione's body was covered by thin, raised red lines, the result of that jinx she couldn't stop. She was also bruised all over from her muscles spasming with the cruciatus. She couldn't remove the bruises completely, but she managed to turn the black and blue into a faint yellow, and she significantly reduced the pain. The arm was something else. Bellatrix had used a cursed knife, and every attempt to close the wound with a healing charm only managed to reopen the scab. Harry said he had just the salve for that. He could prepare it in a jiffy. We'll see. Just let him grab some eggs. It would help with the natural healing process.
If this is another of your magical review things...
I do read other things, Draco. There was no need for both Hermione and Draco to give him such a look. It's an adaptation from a common recipe. Werewolf injuries occur too and scar badly, said Harry as he moved around the kitchen taking eggs, oil and honey with an easiness and sureness they had never seen in Hogwarts.
I learned it from Severus. His version's better than the one they have in apothecaries anyway.
It certainly helped to take the burning sensation away. Harry applied it, and Draco, who had better hands, redressed the wound and tied the bandage. And then Harry announced that he was going to try to make garlic soup. No, he did not read it in Magical Review, enough with that. This was from the book someone called Alphard had loaned Regulus.
I wouldn't mind if it were from Magical Review, Draco confided to Hermione. He saw a recipe against dark spirits in there, and the bathrooms are still cursed, but the food was good.
The bathrooms are cursed? Asked Hermione with the amusement and despondency such a question deserved. Of note, the misery in her tone wasn't so much due to the toilet situation than to the fact that the boys had let it be so for who knew how long.
Of course they are, Granger. Why do you think we take baths in the kitchen?
Merlin, you have no idea how much we need an adult around here.
So they could do magic. That's what Draco meant. An adult so they could do magic. Harry's sass was enough. There was no need for Hermione to start, too. They were fine. They had survived fine. They were eating their vegetables and everything.
The main ingredient of the garlic soup turned out to be bread. Although garlic was also featured prominently, Harry was a bit unsure on its magical properties, if any, because Alphard Black made very liberal use of words like amazing and charming. Alphard Black had been a nut job, and Harry loved the eccentric man to pieces. Given that his name had been burned from the family tree, together with some other clues and old letters, Harry had deduced that he was the same oddball uncle that helped Sirius financially when he left the house, thus meriting his burning in effigy, and later left him his considerable fortune. To Regulus, Alphard had bequeathed his collection of, let's just call it his collection, because there were books, diaries, music vinyl, funny clothes, and assorted random small objects, plus an umbrella. Supposedly, Regulus had been the straight Slytherin son the Blacks wanted. The one who joined Voldemort and got himself killed soon after with barely just time in between to become Draco's godfather. But after sleeping in his room and wearing his clothes and reading his things, Harry was getting the impression that poor young Regulus was something more than all that. He had kept his uncle's collection, for starters. So they ate the soup whose recipe Alphard had brought from his travels through the south of Europe, and Harry declared that obviously this kind of soup was sure to give you courage to attempt any adventure. Which they couldn't really argue against, because it was hot and spicy and precisely the kind of thing you could eat in winter and immediately think, I am going to climb that mountain. Although the latter may be due to Harry's insistence on following Alphard's instructions to the letter, which called for a bottle of red wine to be shared on the table. But in any case, it was a courageous soup, and Harry would not accept any argument on the matter. To their surprise, Creature, who had remained silent and doubtful on how to feel about Hermione's presence in the house, said that that was precisely what the master used to say. And that had been, in fact, his last meal before the master went, and... Sirius?
No, master. Not the master. The master, said Creature.
Oh, Regulus liked it too?
Harry had an uncanny ability to understand what Creature meant, which was no small wonder. However, only Draco was able to phrase the orders in any way that the elf would follow.
Well, have some, will you? No, don't make that face. You know I'll ask Draco to order you to eat the soup. Honestly, Creature, every time the same argument...
Having Hermione around meant they could do magic without fear of the trace being activated. But of course they were all tired, dazed, scared, and wandless in the case of those in which this mattered. Hermione had many things to tell them, and they in turn. They had to figure out a way to let people know Hermione wasn't dead and keep hiding, and think of how to fight back, and remove the blasted vampire from the second floor bathroom. They had many things to do, and they could all wait until the next day. There was no rush to do any magic beyond the healing spells for Hermione. It would be nice learning to cast those in the next 5 minutes or so, though, because they had bruises in their inner thighs from the ridiculously heavy brooms, a road of black and blue down from the groin to almost the knee. Of course, neither of them dared asking Hermione to please cast the spell for them. So what it meant, the most immediate consequence of Hermione's presence, is that they got music back. This may seem like a small matter, but you can't underestimate the healing power of music. The way a melody can speak to your soul and bring it away from the darkness. They moved to the library and ceremoniously lowered the needle of the gramophone. There was some heated discussion over which piece deserved the honor of being heard first. Draco vetoed any of the traditional wizarding music, which limited their options significantly, and he came close to smashing and burning the vinyls. Hermione said in a tired voice that she did not care too much, which made Harry all the more worried about the selection. Harry had been there. Nothing as terrible as the ordeal Hermione had suffered, of course, but he had been before Voldemort, and he had suffered the Crucianus. And then there had been the incident Harry didn't think about, ever, because it terrified him like few things in this life did. Since he didn't think about it, it didn't really count, and therefore his experience was hardly the nightmare Hermione had gone through. But all the same, Harry's point was, he understood. He had gone through something similar, and he knew they needed the right kind of music to wash away the experience. "What about this?" said Draco, holding up one of the pieces from Alphard's collection. The letters on the cover announced, in what had once been riotous colors now faded, that it was a magnificent selection of coplas, whatever that was. There was a woman holding a fan and a carnation on the cover. "Yes, all right," said Harry. Alphard had written on the cover that the music had made him nostalgic of a place he didn't know, and below, a different hand, probably Regulus's, had simply written "yes." It was the perfect combination between lively and sorrowful. You can't listen to something cheery when you are really down, just like Neville had known that cheering charms were of no use for grief. It feels empty and hollow, and like you are listening to something directed to someone else, like you are intercepting someone's message. But you can't listen to sadness either, not for long. This was upbeat, while keeping a mournful flavor that acknowledged some secret misery. This was a music that spoke of determination, of life in hard places taking root and refusing to be trodden. And perhaps it was the music, and perhaps it was Harry, who always reacted so strongly and whose magic was tied to his emotions, but they all felt the stinging satisfaction from a good cry, the aching relief. They had put Hermione in Draco's bedroom, Sirius's bedroom, guessing that the decor would be more pleasant than the one in Regulus's room. The house had bedrooms to spare, but this one was open and had blankets, and at the time, when they returned with an unconscious Hermione, their priority was to heal her and get her in a warm bed, not getting another bedroom ready. Hermione was exhausted despite having spent most of the day sleeping. Harry and Draco were bone tired, too. Soon after an early dinner, they trudged up the stairs and back to the bedrooms, and Draco followed Harry to Regulus's room. These days, they slept in the same bed more often than not. It was just a matter of which bed they felt like sharing. The house was too big and empty, and the sound of another breath beside your own was reassuring. After changing to their pajamas, which weren't pajamas to begin with, just some random soft sport clothes that had been declared to be adequate sleepwear, the house was too cold to sleep with a mere layer of silk, Draco took his book and two pillows and went back to Sirius's room. "Draco, what are you doing?"
"She can't sleep alone," said Draco, as if Harry were failing to see something painfully obvious. "She'll have nightmares. She won't..."
But Draco was already marching in, after hearing the soft...
"Yes?"
that came after his knock. Of course, Harry had to follow him.
"Now, Granger, do you want to sleep between the two of us, or shall we move the bed so you can sleep by the wall? I would offer to take the divan again, but that was made with someone the size of Flitwick in mind."
People often called Hermione a know-it-all. Draco did. Harry did. Although more admiring than taunting. Ron did it every single day of his life. A combination of bewilderment, annoyance, profound admiration, and humorous tease, depending on the occasion. Even Pansy did reluctantly. Yet she now stared at Draco, with his knee-length blue cotton sweater completely speechless.
"I'm sorry," said Harry, already trying to drag Draco back. "He just thought you'd like some company. He spent too much time with Sirius, you know, and..."
"Actually, that doesn't sound too bad," Hermione said, and
Harry would pay money not to see such a devastating expression ever again. How tired and defeated Hermione looked.
But I don't think that...
You will have nightmares, Draco said in that ridiculously confident tone of his. Harry hadn't realized how much Draco tended to interrupt everyone, probably because he always did it with him and he was just used to it. But one day Harry was going to do something outrageous, so Draco would let him finish his sentence. We'll be here. I must warn you, Harry speaks in his sleep and he honks the blankets. I don't honk the blankets, argued Harry. The speaking part he could not fight, because there was a Gryffindor dormitory who would surely magically apparate there the instant Harry tried to deny it. It's for protection. Draco kicks and punches. Hermione offered no comment about how exactly did they know this, and instead had them push the bed to the corner. Nightmares would come, and tears, but it was easier to fall asleep when in a bed full of pillows and blankets and two mad, wonderful wizards between her and the door. People could perhaps find this erotic, but Draco would scoff, and Harry might attempt to punch the unfortunate person who made such a comment, because Hermione had been tortured the day before. And this was about bringing her peace and support. Have some decency, random person. Plus, Draco was indeed wearing a knee-high sweater proclaiming his fondness for the Kenmare Kestrels and pink socks. And if he were to attempt any seduction dressed in that manner, the sheer idiocy of the act would summon his current godfather, who would demand to know what was wrong with Draco. Harry, who was donning a Montrose magpie sweater and trousers ensemble, looked slightly better, but just barely. Severus wished he could tell them. He couldn't, though. He lived with so many secrets and lies it was hard to keep track of all of them. Silence was easier. Still, he wished he could tell them about the three little children, the pureblood, the half-blood, sort of, and the muggleborn. The three little children who were not dead. But the news would eventually be tracked back to him. Severus didn't care about what the Dark Lord would say, because these days he found it rather easy to manipulate him, but Bellatrix would be furious at the publication of her failure, and Lucius would be displeased. As much pleasure as that idea brought him, Bella made for a terrible enemy, and Lucius was still a useful ally, no matter how repugnant Severus found him now. But if he were to find a way to leak the news, Severus thought it would bring back the years Minerva seems to have lost in just a night. She had taken the disappearance of the girl harder than any other news of the war, harder even than the night when they all thought Harry had died when he fell from his broom. They all thought he had died, and yet they all expected a miracle, because it was Harry Potter, the boy who lived. The boy who sent Voldemort away at age 11 and 10 months, but they didn't have the same hopes for Hermione Granger, and Severus was so very glad that everyone had underestimated her. To date, the people at the manor hadn't figured out exactly how she had escaped from her cell. Back at Grimmauld Place, they had a similar thought, although Severus, who so finely chose his words, would not approve of the phrasing. "Messrs. H.J. Potter and D.L. Malfoy," read Draco, "are pleased to announce to all interested parties..." "Really, Harry, this reads like a wedding invitation." "You said the previous one was too informal," said Harry, who was still clutching his first draft. He rather liked it.
"What are you doing?"
"Hey, Hermione." Harry pushed two pillows away to find a shoulder he could squeeze. "Good morning."
"No. We were thinking that we ought to let people know you're all right. You have no idea how upset everyone is. Your ex-boyfriend basically declared war all by himself," Draco informed.
This convinced Hermione that she should at least sit up, because at the moment she couldn't even remember ever having a boyfriend, let alone one with an army. The bed was full of papers, plus the newest edition of The Prophet, which had conspicuously no mention of Hermione whatsoever. Draco said this was probably better than the opposite, because he doubted they would have anything good to say of her under Thickness's government. Hermione pushed her hair up out of the way and took Harry's draft of a public statement.
"Ah ha 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 ha, up yours, Bella," she read.
"Really, Harry?"
"I think it is beautifully concise. Hermione safe and sound, not dead at all. Ah ha 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 ha, up yours, Bella, I hope you sit on a cactus,"
read Hermione one more time.
"I speak from the heart," said Harry.
He had drawn a crude representation to illustrate his point. His second version, while more formal, kept the same essence.
"Miss Hermione Jean Granger is safe and sound at an undisclosed location," read Draco. "Mr. Potter wishes to express his satisfaction and his hope that Mrs. B. Lestrange eats a rotten egg and dies. Mr. Malfoy concurs and extends this wish to the rest of the family."
I like it. There was, of course, the not-so-small matter of how to send the message. They couldn't risk having the message intercepted and traced back to their location, which is why they also couldn't have Creature handle it. If someone recognized the house elf, they would be done. Harry wanted to send it to the Prophet, but had to accept that they would not print it in the Society section, no matter how absolutely funny that would be. The Quibbler would, but Hermione refused because she didn't want to bring any more problems to Luna's father.
"Well, let's just find an owl and send it to Ron in Hogwarts," Harry decided. We have no owl. Yes, let's find one. Harry, we can't just go to the Leaky Cauldron or any other pub and ask for an owl. I think they'll know our faces. I know that. He was a veteran renegade here, even if he'd only been missing for about a week more than Draco. We'll pick an owl somewhere else. I think I'm going to need breakfast before this conversation continues, said Draco. Come on, Granger. This is like the Gamp exception all over again. What does that have to do with anything? And you can call me Hermione. I didn't know that, said Harry, licking some butter from his lips. Creature had been providing breakfast for the last few weeks, and it was always excellent. There had been a couple of minutes of tension when he almost refused to serve Hermione, but she gave him a version of the famous kitchen speech that made the Hogwarts elves strike, and afterwards Creature gave her a tray of croissant. It was unclear whether this was good or bad, because Harry and Draco had eggs and sausages, but it certainly wasn't bad with capitals. Draco exchanged a look with Hermione that said he had been right about needing breakfast. Well, of course, Harry. Owls are wild animals. For them to accept humans and deliver letters, they had to be trained from the egg and fed an enthralling potion for the first 90 days after hatching, plus all the charms that they'll be able to find people. Ah. Oh. It was in our Care of Magical Creatures book. We had a book in that class? Both Hermione and Draco took a long drink of their tea. These are the kind of words that are better received with food in your stomach. Maybe that's why Professor Grubbly Plank didn't like me, mused Harry. Hero of the Wizarding World and their last hope against Voldemort. In any case, as Hermione patiently explained, because this wasn't the first time she had confronted Harry's obliviousness, only magical owls would deliver letters, and they couldn't risk going out to get one. Harry nodded at her words. Corn kernels, he said. Had Ron been there, he would have been able to tell them that Harry had gotten that absent expression that betrayed one of his usual leaps of thought, but then again, Ron never gave warning. Creature, could I have some more bacon? Called Draco. They had been careful, Harry and Draco, despite their young age and certain impulsiveness of character. Why are you looking at me? Harry is the mad I will fight you one. Draco, you broke your wand just to prove a point. They understood very well that they could not afford to take risks. Caution and restraint were more important than any spell. That's what Remus repeated again and again. Think well and consider everything before acting. Flying to get Hermione didn't count because it was Hermione, and they were armed, so that wasn't at all irresponsible. Harry was already preparing his excuses for his eventual reuniting with Remus, but now was different. Now they had Hermione to hide their trace. Now they could step out of the house, which they hadn't done since the week they arrived there.
Coo!
Yes, hello,
said Harry as he threw the crumbs and corn kernels.
Aren't you pretty? I like your purple collar.
Ron ate his dinner mechanically. He had always enjoyed food, though it was one of life's greatest pleasures. Yet lately he found little comfort in it, and after last week and Hermione, he wished he could force himself to enjoy it, because Merlin knew he and everyone else needed to cling to whatever little good things remained. But he just couldn't. He couldn't. He ate because he had to, and because they told him to. And although it still tasted good and he could feel it, he could tell that it was good. Ron couldn't enjoy it at all. Lavender Brown was sitting to his right in silence, poking at her mashed potatoes with disinterest. She had tried to comfort him, been really good and really nice to Ron, but really the only one who came even close to offering any measure of comfort was Neville. He had a way to take the pain and the grief and squeeze it into a ball that lived by your shoulders. You still had to carry the grief with you, but it allowed you to move and go on with your life and get things done. Before that, Ron had felt like he just couldn't move from the floor, like he was made of stone or sand and would never get up. McGonagall had had to excuse Neville from attending his classes for the next 2 days, and he had spent that time comforting students. Not all of them were crying for Hermione, he said, or not exclusively. She was just the most visible example of all the bad things that were happening and that were going to happen. Luna was sitting with Neville in front of Ron, talking softly to a second-year Slytherin boy, because she too had a way to push you out of the sorrow that would otherwise engulf and drown you. Not everything had gone back to the way it was in Hogwarts. The point system was back. Absurd as it was, but the house division had been broken forever. The tables in the Great Hall were just tables now.
Coo!
Said a pigeon, the first pigeon. It was the typical gray pigeon, with two stripes of black on the tail and a collar of green and purple. It had landed between the salad bowl and the tray of potatoes.
Coo!
Said a second pigeon. This one had more purple than green on her chest.
Coo!
Said pigeons number 3, 4, and 5.
Ron, I think they've come for you.
Said Luna, not excited exactly, but with a wondering tone. As if suddenly being accosted by 5,
coo,
actually 6 pigeons, was a thing to look forward to. Pigeon number 4 was brown rather than gray. It began to poke at the roasted potato on Ron's plate. Ron moved his left arm, shooing them away. Said the pigeons indignantly. Out of the brown one. They immediately pressed back and proceeded to climb on top of Ron's plate and arm. By then everybody was staring at him. It was the most interesting thing that had happened all week, and there was nothing threatening in a pigeon, no matter how cheekily it invades your meal. It was something safe to pay attention to.
No, shoo, said Ron. Go, now. Ron, what?
I've no idea, Seamus. Ginny! Ginny, come help your brother!
Maybe if you blast them away...
Don't you dare hurt those pigeons, Ron!
Warned Ginny from what used to be the Ravenclaw table.
It wasn't me! I didn't even say anything!
Ron yelled back, shoo! Said pigeon number one.
Coo!
Agreed pigeon number three, possibly. Ron tried to shoo them away, protect his plate and the rest of the food that the pigeons were exploring with interest, and achieve all this without meriting a jinx from Ginny. He was not very successful. Pigeon number one stole a pea right from Ron's fork, and Ron tried to push it away with his wand.
I have explained it to them, but they keep dropping the letter,
said a voice, Harry's voice, emerging from the pigeon number one, who was stealing a second pea.
Oh, look, it's like a recording of a message. Harry!
Oh my God, it's Harry bloody talking!
The next few words were lost in the raucous tumult of voices. They knew they ought to be silent, but no one could help screaming. The pigeons, as good city pigeons, ignored the commotion and went about their business of pecking at food and stepping over Ron's arms. Multiple wands were produced to poke at the pigeons, but all they managed were some more indignant coos and a finger pecked. They made silence. It took them a minute. But they made silence, and they stopped pestering the pigeons, possibly because McGonagall had suddenly appeared before them. On a curious note, Filch was there, too. The rest of the professors remained at their table, although they were all looking and listening attentively, but Filch had come, as if drawn by the magnetism of any Weasley-related disturbance. Someone coughed. Ginny hit them with a Petrificus Totalis over her shoulder. Ron touched the first pigeon lightly with his wand.
I have explained it to them, but they keep dropping the letter. Oh, look, it's like a recording of a message. Hey, Ron, it's Harry!
The pigeon looked at Ron proudly. Ron petted it with trembling hands and a marveled expression, until pigeon number two pushed it away to take its place. Lavender took the first pigeon in her hands and kissed its head softly. No one spoke. They wanted to, but no one spoke. They held hands instead, and waited in silence. Ron touched the pigeon number two, the one with more purple than green in the collar.
Limited capacity per pigeon, I think. Oh, shit, started again. Hey, Ron, sorry, I haven't written more. We had to go into...
But the message stopped there.
That's 25 words, said Papa Patil, which awarded her with the right to hold the second pigeon.
By then there were so many people pressing against them that Ron could hardly lift his arm again, but he did, and very carefully touched the point of his wand to the puffy chest of pigeon number three, which was white and gray.
Shit, we had to go into hiding after the duel in the ministry,
said Harry in a quick rush of words. Obviously he didn't know if it was the length of the message or the number of words.
Anyway, Hermione's with us. She's fine. She's barely hurt.
There was a clamor. McGonagall started to cry and kissed a befuddled Filch on the cheek. There were dishes and cutlery and glasses dropped everywhere. And at the professor's table, Hagrid and Flitwick were crying, fused in a hug. Ron had to poke the bird three times before the wands penetrated the barrier of white noise in his brain. Ginny picked up that pigeon and sat on Ron's left side without a second thought for whoever had been sitting there. Dean, who had no problem being pushed by Ginny or having her sit in his lap. Hermione was like a sister for Ginny. The only other girl around her age in the borough. There were three more pigeons strutting around the table. Still, Ron had to take deep breaths and drink a glass of water before doing anything else. Luna had moved to sit on Neville's lap to make room for someone else at the table. Katie Bell had pushed the pudding aside and was sitting cross-legged on the table.
Come on, Weasley!
Called someone. So Ron poked the brown pigeon, the cheeky brown pigeon that had first stolen a potato from his plate.
Tell him about Draco,
said Hermione's voice. Hermione, who sounded urgent, like she always did when she was giving instructions. Hermione alive and speaking, and it was just four words. But it was enough, because she was not screaming, she was not crying, she was telling Harry what to do, as always.
Yes,
Harry went on.
Draco's here, he's not dead at all, none of us are dead, and we miss you all.
Ron would have liked to keep that pigeon. He didn't know if they were keeping pigeons, but since everyone seemed to be holding one, he wanted to keep that one with Hermione's voice and words in it, even if they were about Draco, that poor, nice git. But Luna was quicker. Well, not quicker, but she rose from her seat, and she took the bird in her hands with such gentleness that no one tried to fight her. Hagrid used the pause to blow his nose noisily. After him, many followed, although with much less potency. The fifth pigeon had been steadily stuffing itself with corn. It was like the first one, a common gray pigeon with a black tail. Ron poked it, feeling drained and out of emotions for the rest of the week. No more feelings until Monday, sorry. Whatever else happened, Ron couldn't react to it. He was tired and grateful, and all he could think about was that he was starting to feel hungry.
"We should have planned the words before starting to speak. This is ridiculous,"
said Draco's voice. Somewhere in the crowd, there was a big loud gasp from Gregory Goyle.
"Tell them to keep fighting. There is strength in union. Don't let..."
Ron had to touch the pigeon 5 times because the Slytherins plus all the other purebloods in the other houses were going crazy. They had been so sure. A fight broke out between the Slytherin students over who got to hold the pigeon. Blaze and Pansy came to blows, and it was all for nothing because the bird was snatched by Theodore Knott, who passed it to a sobbing Goyle. He really had thought that Draco had been killed. The last pigeon would be Ron's to keep.
"To work with everyone,"
came Draco's surprised voice.
"Don't let them divide us,"
he added. There was a short silence, and then Hermione spoke again, earnest and so, so strong.
"I'm okay, Ron, really. They're not going to win,"
she promised. Another pause. They must have been counting words just like they were doing now, and Harry said,
"Out of corn. Love you. Bye."
"Love you too, mate," whispered Ron. End of chapter 6.
For the full text of this and other stories by the same author, visit the AO3 and Tumblr pages of Endrina. First pass editing by Ohana. Music by Sean Johnson. Special thanks to Sakiko. If you would like me to record a story, voiceover, or character, please get in touch with me using the contact information found on my website, which is located at samgabrielvo.com. There you can also find all the other stories that I've read, as well as links to my Discord server, where I record things live for your enjoyment. And finally, as always, thank you for listening.